Hey, ghoul friends, it's me, Adrian, or Aiden. Either way, I am still your host, and you are still listening to Sustal, the podcast of Ooky Spooky Scary Stories. Welcome back. Thank you all so much for being here. I missed you all so much. I missed doing this. I'm literally giddy right now doing this intro. Safe to say, I am very excited to be back after a very well-deserved, much-needed break. And, you know, I hope that you all also had a restful holiday season, whatever you did, however you did it, whoever you did it with. I hope you all had fun. I hope you were safe. I hope you rested. And, you know, happy new year also. Welcome to 2024. This is the first episode of Sustal in 2024. I have good feelings about this. I did my vision board night before the new year. Apparently, that's what you're supposed to do. And yeah, I'm so excited. I don't know if you all saw the post that I made for New Year's. I'm just, again, so grateful for everything that 2023 brought. And I embrace that for 2024. And the vision for 2024 is just bigger, better, more. I'm so excited for you all to be on this journey with me, I'll say. Not to get too mushy, I'll just say that I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy to have you back. And if this is your first time, what a time to join us. Welcome and thank you for being here. I already have a couple things planned out for the new year that I'm so very excited for. And of course, you can follow along and stay up to date on all of the social media platforms. That's at Sustal Podcast on every single platform. As we get closer to those events and to those things, of course, I will be making posts so that you all can attend if you are around or if it's online or what have you. Speaking of online, the Patreon for the month of December, I released my first attempt at a paranormal investigation. I produced a video with the help of the Paranormal Putas. You know, one of my dearest ghoul friends, Alejandra Sanchez, who was on the show early on in Sustal, and Ghost Guy Ed, we all met up at the Brass Tap in Round Rock, Texas. I think I told you all about this before the break, but the video is up on Patreon. It is a Best Ghoul Friends exclusive. I've posted some clips. I posted like a blooper reel in the first couple of minutes of the video on social media, but the entire video itself, it's a solid video. It's like 50 minutes. It took me forever to edit, but I had such a fun time with that. And again, it was our first foray, I guess I'll say, into paranormal investigation. And we all had a really great time. We learned a lot. I'm sure that if we decide to do this again, there's going to be more to learn, but I'm very excited for that. And I hope that we do another investigation. Again, you can follow all of that on the social media. Also, the Paranormal Putas, of course, they were the ones that invited me to that investigation. They actually did an episode of their own on the Brass Tap. I believe it's an audio only. It's one of their podcast episodes. So if you haven't, make sure to go listen to that. I missed you all so much. I'm so excited to get into today's episode. Before that, just a quick favor to ask you all. I want to do a Q&A episode. I'm going to take a page from the book of Uikiaror. They did this really cool video, and I want to try and do something like that. Maybe do a podcast episode about it and then do like a full-on video for Patreon, of course. Yeah, if you all have any questions that you would like me to answer about Sustal, podcasting, even about me, myself, and I would love to answer your questions. So anything you've ever maybe wondered or have been interested in directly related to Sustal or not, I would be interested to see what people would have to ask. And I guess this is me putting that out there to try and put something like that together. And one last thing, as always, if you have your own scary story that you would like me to share on a Letters from the Beyond episode, you can send them in by visiting sustalpodcast.com and hitting the contact button. You can send it to sustalpodcast@gmail.com. You can send a DM on any of the social media platforms. That's at Sustal Podcast, or you can leave it in a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, or leave it in the Q&A section if you're listening on Spotify. So many ways to get those stories in. And it doesn't have to be just a written story. You can send in a video of something that you captured, an audio recording, a photo, whatever it is, and I will find a way to share it either on an episode or on the socials. With that being said, it's a new year. Why not start the new year with something old, a classic story? Let's go back to the very beginning, the very first episode of Sustal, as we approach the 5-year birthday, which is coming up in April. So if y'all have any ideas for me to celebrate, let me know. Anyway, the first episode of Sustal, today we are resurrecting the story of La Llorona. We'll be right back. In the heart of the Aztec Empire, where the spirits of the ancient gods still lingered, and the echoes of a tumultuous encounter between worlds resonated, there lived a woman named Doña Marina. Her eyes, once filled with hope, had witnessed the rise and fall of empires. She had been given to Hernán Cortés as a gift, an interpreter and advisor, a bridge between two worlds that should have never collided. Marina, later known as La Malinche, had borne the weight of Cortés's ambitions. She spoke the words that sealed alliances and brokered deaths. Her loyalty to the conqueror, an unspoken pact born from the shackles of captivity. Yet, in the labyrinth of her heart, there existed a whispering chamber of rage and confusion. In the early days of the conquest, as the Spanish presence in Tenochtitlan grew, so did the twisted ties between La Malinche and Cortés. He, with eyes that saw only the allure of conquest, had taken her as a possession, a prized interpreter and advisor. Yet for a brief moment, beneath the shadow of looming temples and the gaze of ancient gods, a connection, fragile and fleeting, had woven between them. In the quiet moments between strategy and treachery, Cortés found solace in her company, a comfort that eventually led to the birth of two sons. Yet the ephemeral warmth they shared turned to frost when Cortés, driven by the unquenchable thirst for societal validation, cast his gaze toward a woman of proper Spanish lineage. In the grand theater of courtship, where alliances were forged on beds of political convenience, Maria found herself discarded, a shameful relic of a conquered past. The city of Tenochtitlan, with its grandeur and mystique, witnessed the unraveling of Marina's spirit. The floating gardens held secrets, and the air whispered tales of impending doom. It was in the quiet moments when the moon hung low that La Malinche felt the pull of her inner tempest. The man she had served, the man whose desires had intertwined and conflicted with hers, had forsaken her for a woman who bore the emblem of his European pedigree. The echo of this abandonment reverberated in the chambers of La Malinche's heart, sowing seeds of bitterness. The night she chose to cast her children into the watery embrace of the Great Causeway was not merely an act of madness. It was a symphony of vengeance, an attempt to reclaim control over a life that had been molded and marred by the hands of others. The water below reflected the moon's silver glow, but in her eyes, it mirrored the abyss within. The tumult of emotions, the deception, and the relentless march of colonial violence converged in her heart. La Malinche took her children to the edge of the causeway. The cries of the city were but a distant hum as she, in a trance-like state, released her grip on the living reflections of her pain. The splash of their bodies meeting the water below was drowned out by her anguished cries, a heart-wrenching crescendo that mingled with the ripples on the surface. The children, innocent vessels of her torment, succumbed to the unforgiving currents. La Malinche, now the embodiment of La Llorona, stood on the precipice of the void she had become. In the silence that followed, her eyes, once filled with bright defiance, mirrored the emptiness that surrounded her. As if guided by a force beyond mortal comprehension, La Llorona, the forsaken interpreter, descended into the depths. The waters, now tainted with the sorrow of a woman betrayed, swallowed her form, and the last vestiges of her presence vanished beneath the surface. The night air bore witness to her wails, a haunting melody that echoed through the canals and alleys of Tenochtitlan. La Llorona, the weeping woman, her voice a mournful reminder of the cost of betrayal. In the aftermath of La Malinche's descent into madness, the legend of La Llorona endures. She has become the embodiment of the sorrow that clung to the city's cobblestone streets, a reminder that even in the pursuit of glory, the echoes of the past cannot be silenced. The legend warns mischievous youths of a woman in white, her tattered garments flowing like the specter of a forgotten promise. La Llorona wanders, her eyes hollow, her cries piercing the stillness of the night. Those who hear her know that misfortune trails in her eternal search for her children, sometimes claiming yours as her own. Welcome back, Ghoul Friends. Okay, so just right off the bat, I have several links for this story, some from the old, from the original Google Doc that I made for this, that I'm not sure I had ever, I didn't have a Patreon yet, so this is the first time that this Google Doc is being uploaded to Patreon, so that's patreon.com/sustopodcast if you want to have access to the script and all the direct links. But this first one that I'm going to go through is about La Malinche. It's a Wikipedia entry, and we'll talk about La Malinche more in depth in a while, but I just want to go over quick overview of these, like, of this character, of this person. So this says, Marina or Malintzin, more popularly known as La Malinche, was a Nahua woman from the Mexican Gulf Coast. She became known for contributing to the Spanish conquest of the Aztec Empire by acting as an interpreter, advisor, and intermediary for the Spanish conquistador Hernán Cortés. Boo! Tomato, tomato, tomato. She was one of 20 enslaved women given to the Spaniards in 1519 by the natives of Tobasco. Cortés chose her as a consort, and she later gave birth to his first son, Martín, one of the first mestizos in New Spain. And for those of you who don't know, mestizo is a person, or mestizos are people of mixed European and indigenous American ancestry. So you see this identity claimed or used a lot in northern Mexico, southern Texas. A lot of people identify with that word mestizo because a lot of people, like myself, you know, I am of mixed origin, I guess you could say, is a way of saying that. But, you know, do your 23andMe if you want to. Do that and figure out, you know, maybe if you might be. It's an interesting thing to think about. But this continues. La Malinche's reputation has shifted over the centuries as various peoples evaluate her role against their own societies, changing social and political perspectives, especially after the Mexican War of Independence, which led to Mexico's independence from Spain in 1821. Dramas, novels, and paintings portrayed her as an evil or scheming temptress. In Mexico today, La Malinche remains a powerful icon, understood in various and often conflicting aspects as the embodiment of treachery, the quintessential victim, or the symbolic mother of the New Mexican people. The term Malinchista refers to a disloyal compatriot, especially in Mexico. So I'm just going to bring it up now, and I know that she is brought up again in another source that I want to show you all later, but this idea of labeling La Malinche as, like it says here, some people think of her today as a temptress, as treacherous, as a victim, and they use Malinchista to refer to disloyal people. I understand that, but what if we think about it from the perspective of somebody who is trying to literally just survive and live and not die? This Wikipedia goes on to talk about her name, and, you know, it introduces her as Marina, which I think was her Spanish given name. And there's different ideas about what her actual name was, that, like, the Nahua called her Malintzin, which derived from Malina. And there's all these, like, suffixes and honorifics that come with the language. But I think it's in this entry, they say basically, like, do we really think that the conquistadors were going to be respectful enough of this enslaved woman to say, oh, you know what, this is what your name and your language is, so we're going to give you something that matches? No, they're going to call her whatever the fuck they want to. I just don't think that there's any real way to know what the story is with that. That being said, you then have to wonder, what, you know, what are her options, right? People call her disloyal. They think of her in these really negative lights. But as an individual, I am very scared of death. I like being alive. I want to live. I don't know. I just think it's a very harsh way to think of a person in this situation. This is a person being put in that position to choose, probably. I mean, and I don't know either, you know, I'm talking out of my ass right now. I'm not a historian, but, you know, I'm sure that this person was put in a position to choose life or death. And they were probably like, you know what, you have a skill that we can exploit. So either you let us use the skill or we don't need you. That's, I would imagine that's how that conversation sort of kind of maybe win, right? Rather than she made a choice to help the Spaniards because she wanted to. Like, no, I think she was forced to make a terrible decision and she chose to live. So that's just what I want to put for that conversation. And we will revisit La Malinche in a while. I just wanted to cover the bases because, and I should have introduced this earlier, but when people tell the story of La Llorona, the more that I've told this story, the more that I've read about it, La Llorona is a story that has been told for centuries, hundreds of years. And there is a reason that this story keeps being retold and retold, and a reason that it has, and I'm going to use this word very specifically, survived. I'm just going to put that there. But again, this one version of La Llorona that is told is the story of La Malinche, how La Malinche became La Llorona. And this is obviously the influence of colonialism and the Spanish conquest over Mexico over indigenous people, over people of the Aztec Empire. And so there's going to be a lot of mixing and melding and fusion, I guess, of different ideas and tropes between these two cultures. So this is, I think, one story where it's kind of like an analogy of itself, really, where it is, on the surface level, it's a ghost story, you know, and it's about this woman that does this thing, and then she's set to haunt the earth and try to take your children because she's missing hers and she needs children to get into heaven, right? That's the idea or whatever. But more than that, it's like you think about it. I just kind of talked about it already. You think about, like, why were these choices made? What put her in these position, this like domino effect of positions, to where she was just living her life to where she became enslaved. Then she was being exploited for her skills. Then she gave birth to Cortez's child or children, which, to be perfectly honest, I also do not think was her choice. I think she was forced to bear his children. It's just such a, that part especially is such a sticky situation, because then it's like, you know, she has these children, and I'm not a mother, I cannot speak to that, but I'm sure that she probably formed some sort of bond to these children, that she still loved them, that they were her children, but they were born of such like a tragic experience, such a traumatic experience. So then when the person that caused all this betrays her in this way, she sees his face in the child or the children, and then it just, like, you know, kind of breaks her. It finally breaks her after all this time, right? That's this version of the story. I'll move on. So then the next thing that I have is, it's just an overview of La Llorona. The origins are, again, early colonial times, Central Highlands from the conquistadores. But here it is in this wiki entry. Okay, this says the earliest documentation of La Llorona is traced back to 1550 in Mexico City, but there are theories about her story being connected to specific Aztec mythological creation stories. Quote, the hungry woman includes a wailing woman constantly crying for food, which has been compared to La Llorona's signature nocturnal wailing for her children. This is one of the specific ones that I wanted to reference. This says the motherly nature of La Llorona's tragedy has been compared to Cihuacuatl, an Aztec goddess deity of motherhood. Her seeking of children to keep for herself is significantly compared to Coatlicue, known as Our Lady Mother, or Tonantzin, who's also comparable to the Virgen de Guadalupe, another significant mother figure in Mexican culture. Also, a monster that devours filth or sin, Tonantzin. The legend of La Llorona is traditionally told through Mexico, Central America, and Northern South America. La Llorona is sometimes conflated with La Malinche, like we just said, the Navajo woman who served as Hernán Cortés' interpreter and also bore his son. La Malinche is considered both the mother of the modern Mexican people and a symbol of national treachery for her role in aiding the Spanish. So again, you have these deities, Cihuacuatl, Coatlicue, and Tonantzin, kind of take on the moniker or help, or just because there's like similar tropes in the stories there, it's like blended with the story of La Llorona, right? This continues, stories of weeping female phantoms are common in the folklore of both Iberian and Amerindian cultures. Scholars have pointed out similarities between La Llorona and, again, the Cihuacuatl of Aztec mythology, as well as Eve and Lilith of Hebrew mythology. Author Ben Radford's investigation into the legend of La Llorona, published in Mysterious New Mexico, found common elements of the story in the German folktale Die Weißfrau, I think I said that right, dating from 1486. La Llorona also bears a resemblance to the ancient Greek tale of the demigoddess Lamia, which I told this story in the original episode, in which Hera, Zeus's wife, learned of his affair with Lamia and killed all the children Lamia had with Zeus. Out of jealousy over the loss of her own children, Lamia kills other women's children. The Florentine Codex is an important text that originated in late Mexico in 1519, a quote from which is, "The sixth omen was that many times a woman would be heard going along weeping and shouting. She cried out loudly at night, saying, 'Oh, my children, we are about to go forever.' Sometimes she said, 'Oh, my children, where am I to take you?'" While the roots of La Llorona legend appear to be pre-Hispanic, the earliest published reference to the legends is a 19th century sonnet by Mexican poet Manuel Carpillo. The poem makes no reference to infanticide. Rather, La Llorona is identified as the ghost of a woman named Rosalia who was murdered by her husband. La Rosalia. So, like I said, there's so many different versions and variations of this story. And I think the story as we know it today, it's like an amalgamation of all of those. Or even that if it's not, if you're telling the story of La Llorona by way of La Malinche, for example, then some of the things are similar, but the obviously the constant like through line is the weeping woman. I think the two other things that are pretty consistent with other versions typically are bodies of water and infanticide, and we're going to go over that more right now. The next link that I have here is I have one for Medea. So I just told the one of Lamia, Zeus, and Hera, but I'm going to read this one really quick. This is just like a similarity to a different culture that I found interesting. It says, in Greek mythology, Medea is the daughter of King Aetes of Colchis, a niece of Circe, and the granddaughter of the sun god Helios. Medea is known in most stories as a sorceress, but also as a witch, and is often depicted as a priestess of the goddess Hecate. Medea plays the archetypal role of helper maiden, aiding Jason in his search for the golden fleece by using her magic to save his life and killing her brother to allow him to escape. So one more time. Medea helps Jason search for the golden fleece, and Medea kills her own brother to save Jason's life. Got that? I want you to remember that, because once he has finished his quest, she abandons her native home of Colchis. So, just to keep the tally, first of all, she helps this guy, kills her brother to help him, and flees her native home westward with Jason, where they eventually settle in Corinth and marry. Euripides' 5th century BCE tragedy Medea depicts the ending of her union with Jason when, after 10 years of marriage, Jason intends to abandon her to wed King Creon's daughter, Creusa. Jason argues that their sons will have the tally again. She helps him, kills her brother to save his life, which killing her brother and saving his life is like two things in one. She flees her home, marries him for 10 years, and gives him children. Just to keep the tally, I've lost count already, but anyway, this says, Jason argues that their sons will have a better future in the city if he marries the king's daughter and his sons stay in the same city with him. So he gaslights her, then he claims that he can break the sacred vow of marriage he has with Medea because she is a foreigner. So he gaslights her and uses her origin, her culture, her ancestry against her, and then says, and that makes their marriage illegitimate. Medea is exiled from Corinth by King Creon and is offered refuge in Athens by King Aegeus after she offers to help him get an heir with her magic. And again, she's magic, so I'm sure like she made their life amazing for those 10 years. This says, in revenge against Jason, Medea murders her own sons and Jason's new bride. That one's new, that she goes after the woman. Which I'm like, how much did this new bride know? Like, did she know that she was homewrecking? Did she not know? Because I hate when, you know, people fight over usually some dude, because the dude cheated. I'm like, why are you fighting each other? Fight him. Anyway, this says she kills her children and the king's daughter, aka Jason's new bride, with a poisoned crown and robes so that Jason will be without heir and legacy for the rest of his life. What happens afterward varies according to several accounts. Herodotus in Histories mentions that she ended up leaving Athens and settling in the Iranian plateau among the Arians, who subsequently changed their name to Medes, or Medes, M-E-D-E-S. That story, that is... I think that one is, it's very similar. It's one of the more similar stories to the story of La Malinche as I've come to hear and tell it, is girl meets boy, girl and boy fall in love, girl and boy have children, boy fucks around, cheats on girl, girl loses it, kills children and herself. Except the story with Medea varies because she doesn't take her own life, and she bonus kill, she kills the new bride. That's insane. Jason is the ancient Greek fuckboy. He's a loser. Tomatoes to him too. Put him in the bag with Cortez. the next link that I have here. This is just an entry from the Criterion collection of the 2019 Guatemalan version of La Llorona, I think directed by Jairo Bustamante. I love this movie. You all have heard me talk about it countless times. Anytime someone asks me, you know, top three, what's your favorite movie, whatever, this is always up there in the top three, maybe number one. I did an event recently with Violet Crown Cinema here in Austin. I did a telling of this story, of the resurrected version. So the people that went to that event, they heard this story for the very first time before anybody. So, you know, if you're in Austin and you go to live events, you might hear or see something new that nobody else is going to see for months or maybe even ever. So anyway, just to say, that was a really fun event. I did the story and then we watched this movie together. So thank you, Violet Crown Cinema in Austin, and Bethany from Paranormal Butas for helping me set that up. If you all still have not seen this movie after all this time that I've been talking about it, you need to watch it. It is so, so good. It's very similar to the story of La Malinche. It covers the story of the Guatemalan genocide in, of course, Guatemala, which is based on a true person. I have a link here also in the Google Doc. It's General Efrain Rios Montt. Efrain Rios Montt, also, he was a Guatemalan dictator. He was convicted of genocide, and he also goes in the bag with Jason and Cortez. Tomatoes to him, he's also a loser. But you should watch that movie. It is really good. This next link that I have here. Okay, this is a really interesting one that I really, 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 really wanted to talk about. So this is an entry from Library of Congress. It says it's posted by Stephen Winnick, and this is the Library of Congress blogs. It says, La Llorona, Roots, Branches, and the Missing Link from Spain. This is a long one, and so I'm going to read specific parts of it that stood out to me. And again, you need to look this article up so you can read it. The direct link will be in the SUSE Google Doc for convenience, but I'm just going to read parts of this, and I hope that it makes sense. But this says, interestingly, scholars have suggested that these two types of La Llorona stories, which is the stories of specific meetings with La Llorona or encounter stories. But so it says, interestingly, scholars have suggested that these two types of La Llorona stories may come from different streams of tradition, one of them indigenous to Mexico and the other brought from Europe. Consider, for example, this story. The people heard a weeping woman night after night. She passed by in the middle of the night, wailing and crying out in a loud voice, "My children, we must flee far away from this city." At other times, she cried, "My children, where shall I take you?" Like we heard earlier in the Wikipedia entry. This continues, "This certainly falls within the range of details we would expect in a traditional La Llorona encounter story, but it's actually a Nahuatl account of a bad omen that occurred in Tenochtitlan, now Mexico City, in 1509, 10 years before the arrival of Hernán Cortés and his Spanish troops. The account, which I think is why we get this idea that when people hear La Llorona, it's an omen of bad things to come. It's an omen of death and destruction, right? So maybe it's coming from this specific story that they heard La Llorona roaming the streets years before the arrival of the conquistadores. This continues, the account was collected by the Franciscan friar Bernardino de Sahuagún from Nahuatl speakers in Mexico, who lived through the events they described. The interviews probably occurred in the 1550s and were included in both languages in his work Historia General de las Cosas de la Nueva España, or General History of the Things of New Spain, also known as the Florentine Codex, Book 12. So there's already this idea of La Llorona as an omen, right? And this, again, is from the 1500s. So again, this story, like I mentioned earlier, it's been around for centuries. The next thing I want to read from here, it says, to find out the identity of this wailing spirit, we look to Book 8 of the Codex, where there is a passage that scholars generally take to refer to the same events. In the days of the same Montecuzoma, it happened that the demon Siacoatl walked out weeping at night in the streets of Mexico. Everyone heard it saying, "My children, woe is me that I must soon leave you." And I'm glad that they bring this up, but this says, although in the passage he calls her a demon, in Book 1, Sahagún describes Sihuacuatl as one of the most important goddesses of the Aztecs. She is associated with small children, and a crib or cradle was one of her distinguishing marks. Sahagún's description in Book 1 says, and they also say that she carries a crib with her as someone who carried her child in it, and she goes to the market among the other women, and disappearing, she would leave behind the crib. When the other women discovered that the crib had been forgotten there, they would look to see what was inside, and there would be a flint, like iron, of the rough kind with which they killed those they sacrificed. By this, they understood that it was Sihuacuatl who had left it there. One more striking parallel between Sihuacuatl and La Llorona is that both are associated with infanticide. In Book 8 of the Florentine Codex in the entry for Don Martin, governor of Atelulco, Sahagún's informants reported, "In this time it came to pass that the demon that in the form of a woman walked and appeared by day and night and was called Cihuacóatl ate a small boy who was in his cradle of the town of Azcapotzalco." These similarities between La Llorona and Cihuacóatl have led many scholars to believe that the traditional image of La Llorona, and thus the stories about her that are mostly descriptions, derive from this Aztec belief. Thomas Janvier, writing in 1910, held this belief. "The legend is not, as all of the other legends are, of Spanish-Mexican origin. It is wholly Mexican, like entirely Mexican, a direct survival from primitive times. La Llorona is a stray from Aztec mythology, an ancient powerful goddess living on, her powerful for evil lessened, but still potent, into modern times." Américo Paredes expanded on this observation in 1971, adding other figures of indigenous myth and folklore that could have contributed to facets to the many descriptions of La Llorona. Paredes says, "The literary legend of La Llorona struck deep roots in Mexican tradition because it was grafted on an Indian legend cycle about the supernatural woman who seduces men when they are out alone on the roads or working in the fields. At times, she destroys her lovers after giving herself to them, but often she is helpful as well as passionate and may make a man's fortune or help him raise a fine crop of corn. She is Matlacihua, or woman of the nets among Nahuatl speakers, and other language groups such as the Mixes and the Popolucas knew her by other names. As La Cegua, she has been reported as far north as Texas, and she is also known as far south as Panama." Okay, so I'm going to jump ahead because there's some other stuff here. It says in Francis Tours, 1947, A Treasury of Mexican Folkways, which is a book that I am going to buy. See, this is the thing that also happens to me when I make episodes, is I see books and I'm like, I need that. I want to buy it and I need to read the entire thing and have it so I can reference it. I have a list of books on a wish list that I'm waiting to get. Hopefully I can get them one day. This says, "There's an account of the legend that seems very carefully worded. This one I really enjoyed. It says, in Mexico City itself, the legend of La Llorona is still related. She was a pretty but humble maiden named Luisa, with whom a rich young man of high society fell in love. He did not marry her, but according to custom, furnished a casita, a love nest, for her, where they were happy for many years. His friends visited and respected her, and they had 3 children. Finally, his family prevailed upon him to marry a girl of his own class. He told Luisa he was going to marry, and she made a scene. He stopped visiting her. She was an uninvited guest at his wedding in the big cathedral. She came home maddened with grief and sent a dagger into the tender bodies of each of her children, one after the other. Then, horror-stricken, she ran wildly through the streets, calling for her little ones, sending terror into the hearts of all who had heard her. According to some of the chronicles, Luisa was tried and garroted for her crimes, and on that same day, her lover Don Nuno de Montes was buried after having committed suicide." Again, a different variation of this story. So then, this entry goes on to talk more about the origins of the story of La Llorona, and if it is, again, there's kind of this debate if it is from indigenous Mexicans or if it is from Mexican-Spanish influence or if it is completely from Spanish influence or if it has become this thing that is bigger than those three or is made up of those three. Okay, I'm skipping ahead, and this next part is interesting. So Stephen Wittick, the person who posted this on this blog, says that they may have uncovered something of a, quote, missing link, and it points to whether or not there was mention of La Llorona tales in Spain, I think before the conquest. And so, again, this idea of, is it indigenous Mexico? Is it Mexico by influence of the Spanish, or was it from Spanish alone? It was published in Spain in 1866 by José María León y Domínguez, a Jesuit academic from Cádiz. The central character, a woman named Elvira, ends up a weeping female ghost called La Llorona. And this says, Domínguez's story, El Pozo de La Llorona, includes a frame tale told in the first person in which the narrator, presumably Domínguez himself, visits the small Andalusian town of Rota and learns that there is a belief in a frightening apparition called La Llorona. La Llorona is invoked by adults and teenagers to frighten younger children, as always, right? Overhearing this, the narrator questions several adults about who or what La Llorona is and gets the story from an old man. There's a link to the full story, and I will be linking to that, of course, in the Google Docs, but it is El Pozo de La Llorona. You can get it on Google Books. It's available as a PDF. The summarization, again, this is Stephen's summarization. In his reign, King Pedro the Cruel kept an eye on villages like Rota to see if they were governed well. In those days, there was already a formidable castle there. The Castilian in charge of it was a haughty, bloodthirsty, arrogant young man who did not recognize or respect any divine or human law and who overran anyone who opposed his criminal desires. At the time, there was also a fisherman who was a widower and lived alone with his young and beautiful daughter, Elvira. Elvira helped her father with the fishing and mending nets, but she also enjoyed festival days when she would go to the plaza and dance. She was so beautiful that she outshone all the other young women, and so she became prideful. When the mutilated bodies of several village children were found, again, there's that mention of infanticide, the castellan was suspected of the crimes, and Elvira's father warned her to keep clear of him, but she decided that if she made the castellan fall in love with her, she would be elevated above her peers. Similar to the story of Hernán Cortés and Jason, right, and Medea, this idea of elevating your social status. This continues, one day the fisherman saved the castellan's life, and this led to a meeting between the castellan and Elvira. A week later, there were rumors of a courtship, and a week after that, Elvira disappeared. Her father searched everywhere, eventually realizing she must have gone to the castle, so he went there himself and begged the castellan to let his daughter go. From a high window, Elvira told her father she was now the lady of the castle, and sarcastically added that she had traded his poor shack for a rich palace. Rude. This continues, the father ran away in despair, crying that his daughter was the lady of the castle, and the people believed he was mad. The next morning, the townspeople awoke to find a gallows raised in front of the castle and the castellan hanging from it. People believed that King Pedro had discovered the castellan's crimes, again, killing the children, that's what it's alluding to, and had him hanged. Elvira became the subject of public ridicule and could not bear it. In despair, she threw herself in a well, the body of water, and drowned. From that day on, every night at 12 o'clock, she rose from the well, wandering through the streets, and entered the castle, crying and moaning all the while. And people said that the punishment that heaven had imposed on Elvira here on earth for her pride was to mourn the death of the castellan, leaving the well of La Llorona every night. So that is really cool, this extremely early version from Spain. Stephen Winnick agrees. He says it's intriguing. It is set in the reign of Pedro I from 1350 to 1369. That's the story of the setting. Shortly before the earliest White Lady tales discussed by Kirtley, it includes themes present in many Mexican versions of the Llorona tale, but they are organized differently. Again, and Stephen Winnick notices as well, it says water features prominently in the story, but it comes in the form of the sea and a well, rather than the rivers and the lakes more commonly referred to in Mexican stories. So again, her father was a fisherman, the sea, she dove into a well, there's that body of water. Infanticide is an important element in the story, but again, it is not La Llorona who commits the crimes in this story, it is the man she falls in love with. Elvira may be turning a blind eye to the castellan's crimes, or she may be in denial. She is certainly guilty of ignoring the rumors of the castellan's infanticides and wooing him anyway. Again, this idea of improving the social status and ladder climbing. She is also guilty of excessive pride in her own beauty, which is an element in some Mexican and Mexican-American versions, including that of Camille Acosta and that of Joe Hayes, which Stephen said they would post in a future blog. Two things that I wanted to... or the last things that I wanted to read about this from this blog entry that stood out to me. This says, exploring the ways in which these native roots and European branches interact is not only an interesting exercise, it also has implications for how we interpret the stories. It suggests, for example, that the story may be interpreted as commentary on the very culture contact that created its current form. As Bettes points out, the assimilation of European ideas into the native worldview, one that includes an understanding of a woman weeping for her children, would allow the indigenous peoples of Mexico through the figure of La Llorona to account for and even explain the effects of European contact and conquest. Because of the dynamism of the tale, La Llorona and her story can be used to comment on the changing worldview of the Mexicas both pre- and post-conquest. And again from Bettes, the last thing in this entry says, and this is probably my favorite part, an accounting of La Llorona's history helps us to see the weight and endurance of this legend, as well as the various forces that helped shape it. La Llorona has been with and part of the greater Mexican cultural tradition for approximately 500 years, as testament to the power of Chicanes storytelling tradition that includes La Llorona. Her stories endure into the present. So, Stephen Winnick, thank you so much for this entry. this, I highly suggest you all to go read this. Again, it is in the Library of Congress blogs, and it is titled La Llorona, Roots, Branches, and the Missing Link from Spain. It was published in 2021, and the direct link will be in the Sisto Google Docs. I feel like this entire entry, it covered things that I have said about this story, that I have thought about this story, that I have not been able to put in words about this story. I think it encompasses all of those things perfectly. Yeah, it wraps in all of these different ideas, and it even not only about the story itself, but then it talks about like the endurance and the importance of oral storytelling, which is, that's all that Sisto is. It's oral storytelling. I've been saying this a lot of interviews. I have not created anything new with Sisto. I am simply reformatting it, reorganizing it. I'm putting it in a different kind of structure, but oral storytelling is what I'm doing. And this, I think the story of La Llorona, and why I really wanted to start the new year with this story, is that that's kind of the vision, you know, for this next year and hopefully many years to come, that Sisto will endure the way that these stories have over all of this time, especially like the story of La Llorona, which we now know has its own roots in many different cultures and then came together to form this like super story, this super monster about this spirit, about this person, about these people, right? Okay, so the last link that I wanted to go through with you all, this is a summary of a paper. It's from an educational publication or an academic publication from Oxford Research Encyclopedias. And this was written by Rita Cano Alcala. And it's titled La Malinche, La Virgen de Guadalupe, and La Llorona, The Recuperation of Divine Supernatural Powers in Late 20th Century Chicana Literature. And I'm going to read this to you. It is, I think, extremely relevant to this entire conversation, of course. It says, myths and legends are the way in which human beings try to understand the divine or supernatural and their relationship to it. Created by humans, myths are reflections of the values and beliefs of the people, time, and place from which they emerge. Once they are in circulation and affirmed by religious doctrine or official historiography, myths are used as an explanation and then a legitimation of why things are the way they are. They become instruments of vigilance and control of human behavior, which in patriarchal culture means principally of female behavior. Patriarchal cultures produce myths that justify and reproduce the principles of male supremacy. Because again, let's tally up one more time. And like I mentioned earlier, just to like really water it down, when you see people fighting because their man cheated on them, and they might not even know about each other and they're fighting, I'm always like, why are you fighting each other? Jump him. I don't condone violence on this podcast. But yeah, it's this idea of like, I think maybe like the wrong people being punished, or only them being punished. Like obviously killing kids is not the answer, but why is the story only that La Llorona is the one being punished? Like when we talk about the story of the girl who danced with the devil, like who is being punished and why are they being punished? And with this story, obviously, you know, we know why, but I think when kids are told this story, they're told the point of the story is, so don't be out at night. Maybe you can also include, so don't hurt people that trust you. Don't hurt people that love you. Don't hurt people that are putting their faith in you, right? Which you could argue are big ideas for little kids, but you know, kids are easy. You kind of tell them something, and if they don't understand, they're probably going to be like, okay, sure. But at least they have that seed planted, right? I could be thinking extremely deeply about this, which is what we do here, right? This continues, in the early centuries of Christianity, the Virgin Mary supplanted and absorbed the rituals and feast days of some of the pagan goddesses, but she was not endowed with their powers. Christianity reinforced an insistence on the one true male God. The mother of Jesus, the Virgin Mary, is the lone female figure in Christianity. The Catholic Church has sought to limit the Virgin Mary's role to that of vessel bringing the Son of God into the world, but she has resonated in the hearts and some believers to an equal or even greater degree than Jesus. The Church has responded to the popular religious zeal for Mary by making every effort to rein it in. The Church has officially recognized Mary, but with each proclamation it has put a nail in the proverbial coffin of woman's equal representation in the Church. Mary has been described as a Trojan horse for the perpetuation of male hierarchical control and supreme power in the Catholic Church. If I could snap the loudest snap for that paragraph alone, if I could tongue pop the loudest tongue pop for that paragraph, wow, 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 wow. Again, these ideas of using these stories to control people's bodies, to control women, to like strip people of their autonomy. And again, and this I think the story of La Llorona is very heavy on like feminist theory. One of the fun parts for me, at least, in telling these stories and dissecting them and trying to think critically about them is to do just that. You know, like when I'm telling stories about these cryptid femmes, for example, that go out and attack drunkards for being drunk, I'm like, what is the message there? Why are we punishing people who are suffering with substance abuse, right? Or battling substance abuse or experiencing it, whichever word you feel comfortable using. But, you know, I want people to think more critically about these stories that have been passed on for example, with La Llorona, for centuries. Okay, I'm going to skip to the last paragraph of the summary. This says, girded in a cultural nationalism with the traditional Mexican family as its foundation, the Chicano civil rights movement of the 1960s and 70s invoked Malinche and Malinchista as epithets against women who pursued leadership roles or feminist principles. In response to these efforts to reaffirm and justify the virgin-whore dichotomy, personified in the figures of La Virgen de Guadalupe and La Malinche, Chicana writers, artists, and scholars produced work in the late 20th century that exposes the patriarchal values that undergird all three figures and offers empowering feminist reinterpretations and positive affirmations for female sexuality. So I know the summary it was a mouthful. Definitely. It is a brainful, I think, but I like to point to people who write things like this as a way to like supplement and back up the ideas that I'm trying to honestly glaze over, because that's why this is a summary of like an entire, I'm sure, well thought out, well written paper, because you can go very deep with these ideas. Yeah. I just wanted to point to this source as like a, you know, okay, I feel like I'm on the right path with the themes that we're going over when we're talking about this story. Welcome back, Ghoul friends. Oh my goodness, what a way, right, to come back into the new year. I'm so excited to be here again. Like I said earlier, I missed y'all. I missed doing this. I hope that you missed me. I'm looking forward to a very exciting, fun-filled 2024 for Susto. Like I mentioned earlier, I have some things lined up for the new year already. Make sure to follow along on social media for any and all updates on the show, not just the podcast, but also things that I am doing either in person or other things that I'm doing online. You can do so by following @SustoPodcast on every social media platform. And as always, if you have your own story to send in, whether it is a written story, a video, a picture, an audio recording, anything that you think I should share on a Letters from the Beyond episode or on the social medias, you can send that. You already know, website, email, social media, reviews, or Spotify. And speaking of sending things in, I would love it if you sent in questions that I can use to film a Q&A, either episode and or a Patreon exclusive video. Yeah, again, questions that you have either about the show, about myself. Yeah, I'm just interested to know what you all might be interested in, and I would love to answer those questions. I'm an open book. Y'all should know this by now. I pour my heart and soul out in the show, and I'm not shy, so let it rip. I would love to answer your questions. Speaking of Patreon, if you have not signed up yet, you can sign up on patreon.com/SustoPodcast. One of the most recent perks I put up for Best Ghoul Friends, a Best Ghoul Friend exclusive, was the Brass Tap investigation that the Paranormal Putas invited me to go on. Again, it is a nearly hour-long video. It was so much fun making it, and I hope to make another one with the things that we learned while we were out. I think we got some interesting stuff on there. I would love for y'all to check that out. Again, it is a Best Ghoul Friend exclusive on Patreon. You can see the blooper reel and the first couple minutes of it that I posted on the social medias, on TikTok especially. Speaking of Patreon, thank you so much to the patrons. Your support, it means the world to me. It helps me reinvest in the show and keep it going. So thank you all so much. And you are Liza, Sadie, Rachel, Alejandra, Luther, April, Mario, Eva, Dee, Victoria, Josette, Sam, Angela & Co., Mandy, Jules, Lori, Jeannie, Desiree, Anna C., Ashes, Neresa, Rachel, Asukena, Rios, Anna, Marlene, Chata, Javier, Desiree, Aaliyah, Holly, and Divine. Thank you all again so, so much. I truly appreciate it. Happy New Year. I will talk to you all in the next one, and break up with him. Bye.